Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us today. A well-known NPR personality will be at Wharton Center tonight, and Current State's Melissa Benmark is here to tell us more. Welcome back, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. Good to be back. To longtime NPR listeners, Michelle Norris is a very familiar voice. She's the former co-host of All Things Considered. She's the curator of the Race Card Project. Of course, you've heard those offerings on Morning Edition. Her memoir, The Grace of Silence, is also one of the books in the most recent One Book, One Community program. She'll be at Wharton Center tonight, and recently we talked about what keeps her mostly busy these days.
The Race Card Project has really become the central part of my portfolio. I spent a lot of time working on the website and cultivating the website and going through the vast number of submissions that pour in every day, and also working with my producer, Walter Watson, to produce these lovely radio segments where we take the submissions, these submissions that start with just six words, that often lead us down this journey of candor and exploration of racial identity and this place where we really learn a lot about individuals and communities and about America, and increasingly even about other places, because many of the submissions now come in from overseas. So that's where I spend a good deal of my time, is really cultivating the conversation and the content around the Race Card Project.
How did this project begin?
The project began as an accident. I mean, or at least as a happy accident. I didn't intend for this to, you know, turn into the juggernaut that it's become. When I wrote the book that you mentioned, The Grace of Silence, the book that the freshman class at Michigan State is reading now as a community, I knew when I went out to various communities that I would be asking people to participate in a conversation about race, and I was concerned about that because I thought that conversations about race are often difficult, and I anticipated that people would be uncomfortable. Even when they heard me talk about my story and what I'd learned in exploring the stories that my family didn't feel comfortable talking about, that would not create more comfort, that it would just create discomfort, because I thought race was this thing that no one wanted to talk about. And I can happily say that I was wrong. Because when I asked people to participate in this little exercise and share their thoughts and observations and experiences around race in just six words, I realized in looking at my inbox that people were eager to have this conversation, that the postcards that I asked people to fill out started to pour in, and then when I moved the project online and created a website, they came in ever larger numbers. And so that's how people participate in it now, and they find it in all kinds of ways. Sometimes they hear about it when I visit a community or a campus or a church or an organization. They hear about it on the radio when they hear the segments that we were just talking about. But a lot of times they just stumble on it, and I don't know how they find it. And, you know, either through social media, which has really expanded the footprint, or someone, you know, hears about it from someone else. I don't know how people find it, but they, when they do, what they serve up through just six words are often deep and rich and interesting and prickly and incredible stories that often start with just six words. And if you spend any time on the website, and I hope that you have, you see that it often starts with just six words. And then people, once they open that spigot, it's like, oh, well, those are my six words, but let me tell you what else I have to say. This is the story behind those six words. And so they will send in their six words and an accompanying essay. And then increasingly what they do even beyond that is send in pictures. So this is my story, this is the backstory, and this is who I am. And I guess that has created sort of modeling behavior, because when people see that, oh, well, this is the kind of conversation about race that I've been asked to participate in. Well, if that's what you're asking for, let me jump in here also. And I've got something to say too. So it's become this sort of rich and robust dialogue that includes people who might not ever sit down at a table together, might not even acknowledge each other if they saw each other on the street.
Do you notice that during times when race is especially in the news, issues of race, like now with Ferguson and Michael Brown, that submissions increase, or have they just been pretty steady?
They've been pretty steady, and they sometimes increase around those big seismic issues, but what I appreciate about the collection of stories is it's helped me understand something important as a journalist. And I think, Melissa, you might recognize this in our craft, that we often have discussions about race or around race when there is something that happens that is monumental, when sort of the earth shudders in this sort of quake. Behind a case like Trayvon Martin or Jordan Davis or what happened in Ferguson with the killing of Michael Brown or the election of the first black president or debates over immigration reform or questions around Asian quotas at universities, but we don't often talk about the subtleties of how race influences our life, and that's what you see in a very important way in the cards that come in and in the consistency of the cards that come in. So it's not just a reflection of those big moments that seize the headlines, but rather the small way that race colors our life, if I can use a pun. If you are a person of mixed race and what it means when you go to enroll at a university and you have to fill out a form and you have to check a box.
Right.
And you have to choose which box you check and which part of your family that you accept and which part of your family that you're forced to deny by picking only one box. In Michigan, for instance, we also partnered with the University of Michigan prior to the partnership with Michigan State. And one of the six-word submissions actually led to the university really thinking about the experience of many of the freshmen when they entered campus if they were Muslim. Because the six words, and I'm doing this by memory, so I hope I remember this right, was foot in sync, awkward first encounter.
Oh, wow.
And it was from a student who, because of her faith, washes her feet at certain times of the day. And she met one of her roommates when she was in the middle of doing this and explained, you know, what was going on. But in that conversation, you know, as it came up, there was this rich and robust conversation about, well, you know, should there be stations around campus where this could happen, where people could do this in a more comfortable way? Should there be a discussion so that people who come to university from all kinds of backgrounds and faiths learn a little bit more about each other? And it was just, you know, an example of an encounter or an expression that someone might not think of when you think about a traditional conversation about race in America, which, you know, as I said, is usually about those sort of big moments where everyone is focused on something that's happened that's worked its way up to the top of the news cycle. The other thing that's been surprising to me is how in the media sometimes we define the conversation about race in a particular way, that it's usually involving people of color, usually through a civil rights construct, black Americans and white Americans trying to figure out how to live together, that it doesn't often include or doesn't always include people of other races, that, you know, Asian Americans maybe aren't included fully in what we traditionally see as a conversation about race, or that Latino Americans aren't included as often because that's really about an ethnic identity as opposed to a racial identity and the complexities there. And sometimes, you know, the submissions that come in don't even have anything to do with skin color. I mean, there are a number, if you type in the words red hair in the search function of the webpage, you might be surprised at how many submissions come up from people who have red hair, who talk about what that means for them and how they sometimes are placed in a box because of the assumptions that people make about them. Didn't get a job promotion because I have red hair and someone thinks that I have a particular temperament because of that. That was surprising to me and interesting. And I guess I'm glad that people feel like they have a place to segue into a conversation that they might otherwise be left out of.
You're trying to help people have that conversation, and this is a difficult question, but within that wide subject, is there a particular aspect that you find people have the most difficulty talking about more than everything else? I guess I was sort of thinking of it as, you know, the elephant within the elephant in the room.
I don't know if I could identify the most difficult aspect of conversations about race. There's you know, a lot of, we cover a lot of prickly territory, and I guess the goal through this is to not necessarily, you know, this is not a salvo or this is not a panacea. You won't, you know, I tell people you won't go to the website or participate in this and somehow feel that that you've solved America's problems with race, but the idea is to just keep people at the table no matter how difficult the conversation is. That you might not agree with everything. In fact, if you go to the website, if you participate in this exercise, I guarantee you that you're going to encounter something that's going to make you squirm or that might make you quite uncomfortable. And yet you will leave with a greater understanding of someone who leads a life that's very different than yours. And the goal is to keep people at the table when having that conversation, because, you know, I don't know what's the most difficult aspect of this conversation, but whenever things get difficult, often what we do is pull away from the table and say, I'm done with this. And in fact, that's why I called it the Race Card Project, because when people talk about playing the race card, that's a phrase that I don't much like.
It's a conversation killer.
Well, and that's exactly what it's meant to be. It's an accusatory finger. It's saying, you're saying something that's making me uncomfortable, so let's shut down this conversation. You're playing the race card. And so I chose that title to try to take that phrase, Melissa, and turn it on its head. And instead of being used in a way to shut down a conversation, to perhaps use it, and I admit being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but you know, I was trying to also be serious about keeping that conversation going, to keep people, again, at the table, even if they don't agree with each other, perhaps especially when they don't agree with each other.
Why six words? How did you arrive at that?
There is a sort of an understanding around expressing yourself in six words. There are exercises where, you know, where people have, you know, used six words to express themselves, and so I knew that there would be some understanding and comfort around that. I had, at two important periods in my life, have had people force this idea upon me to help me tackle difficult subjects. When I was a reporter at the Washington Post, I had an editor who would stroll through the newsroom, and you could write your way onto or off of the front page of the paper if you were asked to describe your story. You had to do it in one sentence, and the shorter the better. And if you could explain that story in six words and hold their attention, and then from there, you know, explain sort of the background of the story, you help them understand that you had, you know, a full understanding of the story at hand. And then when I was in college, I had a professor who told us that if you have a very difficult writing assignment, and it's something I still do to this day, that if you have a very difficult writing assignment, if you can break the back by just reducing the story to six words, if you can figure out what the essence of that story is in six words, then you can take a series of building blocks and put together an entire structure around that story. But you first have to break it down. And that idea of distilling something that's very difficult to just six words, particularly around a subject as big and roiling and prickly as race, seems to really work.
I want to talk a little bit about your memoir, The Grace of Silence, which I expect you'll be talking about at your Wharton Center appearance somewhat. The first chapter of the book is about your dad and your relationship with him and the end of his life. I found that to be real personal because my dad was a huge influence on my life, and actually he was a journalist, and he's gone now. And I was just struck by so many women write about their mothers. But what do you think it is about dads? What is that magic thing that a strong dad can give to a daughter that it sounds like your father gave you?
Oh, yeah, he's. I miss him every day. A day does not go by where I don't have this impulse to pick up the phone and tell him about something I saw or experienced, and it just kills me that he never met my husband. He doesn't know his grandchildren. And I wish so badly that, I wish so desperately that he had an influence on their lives. And part of writing the book was to help them understand him.
Help your children understand him?
Yeah. Help to give them his story and the things that I was able to learn that he never shared with me, and things that I think he probably, if he had lived long enough, might have shared some of those things, because my relatives who did, you know, live into their later years entered a period of honesty and disinhibition and started telling those very difficult stories that they kept from us when we were younger. But your question about what fathers, you know, the roles they play in the young woman's life, there's something really special about a relationship between a father and a daughter, and there's something special about any relationship between a parent and a child. But from my personal experience, there was something very special about that relationship, in part because when my parents divorced, I lived with my father. And so I kind of grew up like Gidget. But also there was, when you have two parents, you get two sort of dimensions to a relationship, and that's different in different ways. So where one parent may pass on strength of one kind, another parent shows you that strength can be expressed in lots of different ways. You know, when I think about the way that he used his life, the example of his life is not his words, because he was a man of few words. He was not a chatty guy. But he used small things to pass on sort of big lessons. And I think about even, you know, we're coming to the end of summer. And so the sound of summer in my household so reminds me of him, and that's the sound of baseball on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if your father did this also, but he would watch TV with the sound turned down, but listen to the game on the radio. I married a man who does the same thing. He'd turn the radio, you know, up and listen to the game, but watch the game on TV. And I remember going to games with him, and he would buy those little books at the beginning of the season and carry a pencil to all the games that we actually went to. We would go to the Twins games in the old stadium. Not the Metrodome, but the old stadium.
The real stadium.
And he would keep score. You know, but baseball wound up being a vehicle for teaching life lessons. And there are life lessons that I learned from my mother. And my mother, thank God, is still with us. And she, you know, and there are all kinds of life lessons I learned from her, and I learned from the kitchen and the garden. But, for instance, my father used, you know, other ways to teach certain kinds of lessons. And baseball was one of those places where, you know, we talked about humility and honor and, you know, all those sort of big life lessons, but learned, you know, sitting in the stand, eating ice cream out of little cups and scoring baseball. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
It's a beautiful answer.
Yeah. Well, anyone, and they help you understand, I mean, they're, you know, deciphering another gender is something that few of us master, you know,
that's a good
late
point.
Into our lives. And that relationship, that early relationship with a parent of the opposite gender really can help you do that.
And you have children, and kids are always more tuned into what their parents are doing than we think they are. Have you had any unexpected conversations with them on the subject of race as a result of the Race Card Project?
You know, I have them all the time. The kids, they actually enjoy the Race Card Project. They'll dip into the website, and we have used the exercise at their school, which was really wonderful, to deepen the conversation there. And things got a little uncomfortable at times because of the honesty that was served up. But mm-hmm. as a community, it really did make us stronger. And one of the things that I appreciated about that was something we talked about earlier, is that people who felt like they never could fully participate in the conversation about race felt like they could stand up and say something. And many of them, for instance, were white students or white faculty members who always felt, well, it's not my story, or, you know, I have to tiptoe through eggshells if I want to participate in this conversation, or I don't feel like I have the credibility or the authenticity to have this conversation, and they felt like they could step up and fully participate. But it also, even within our household, has allowed us to have more honest conversations. My children, I think, in part because of the questions that I was able to ask my elders in the book, feel emboldened to ask the members of our family about their experiences and their outlook. We're in a period where there's all kinds of big anniversaries now, 50-year anniversaries for the March on Washington, the passing of the Civil Rights Act. Next year, the march in Selma. And the kids are really curious about that. And so they ask questions, and they record conversations. And I love that they're capturing that part of our historical wealth through their curiosity and through their stories. And sometimes when they ask those questions, if, you know, they're talking to someone, oh, you don't want to hear that story, or America was a much more complicated place back then. And I'll hear one of the kids say something like, well, let's start by, why don't you just tell me in just six words, and then we'll go from there. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, they really are paying attention to what I'm doing. going.
You must have just about fallen over the first time you heard the six words thing come out.
So, yes, they really do pay attention.
Wow. So, for them, you know, going into the world as adults eventually, what are your biggest concerns for them as far as race relations? You know, America is too small. It's worldwide now.
You know, I think about the world that they will inherit, and it's so different. And race relations have improved in so many ways. But I hope that they will be bold in confronting things that don't feel right to them and in pushing forward the conversation. And this is a tough one for me because people will ask me, well, you know, your parents didn't talk about race, and then you explored this idea and you wrote a whole book about it, and what do you tell your own kids about race? And I try to create a space where we can have conversations about it, but not obsess about it. I don't want them to go looking for race or racism, because those are two different things, under every rock. I don't want them to go out into the world with their fists balled up. But I do want them to go out to the world with their eyes open. And so finding that balance is not easy, but I hope that they will achieve that, that they don't run away from the issue, but they're also willing to approach, if not confront, at least approach the issue. And you know what I do think about? I think about, you know, you can't help but think about your sons in the wake of something like Ferguson. And the fact that you do have to have the conversation with them. And the fact that, you know, my son will go out with his friends, and they're a multi-ethnic gaggle of kids. And when they show up at the shopping mall, and they're all wearing their ridiculously large down jackets and their saggy pants, because that's what kids wear these days.
Right, right.
That my son might be more likely to be followed in the store at the mall. And I wish that wasn't the truth, but it is. And so I have to help them navigate that world and to continue to reach for the world that I think that they can envision. The idea, you know, I was just working with the kids on homework last night, and they were reading a series of Langston Hughes poems, Let America Be America Again, and I Too Sing America, and we were talking about the American dream and the tension between the American dream and the reality of life in America. And in learning my father's story, one of the things he taught me that I really embrace is he taught me to love a country that sometimes lets you down. And that is such an incredible gift, to recognize that the American dream is sometimes feels like it's outside of your reach, but you continue to strive for it. That you continue to push for the America that you believe in, even if the America that you experience is some distance from that. And if I can give my kids, if I can pass that lesson that was given to me, that gift that was given to me, if I can pass that on to them, I feel like, you know, we'll perhaps be in good stead.
Well, Michelle Norris, it is an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, and I thank you so much for taking the time today to do that, and we're looking forward to your appearance at Wharton Center.
I look forward to getting there. Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.